Jesse, can you sound check something for me?
What are you checking? You checking reality?
Yeah. Do you remember Max Webster?
Sounds familiar. No.
Well, Charles wouldn't know him because they were a Canadian band that never really made it in the States. But I'm surprised you don't know about them, Jesse. Anyhow, they had a song, Check It Out, which maybe that'll be our...
I say, they sound familiar.
I'll put them on the show, and that way YouTube will demonetize us again. Hang on for one sec.
Yeah, why are we monetizing?
I never turned it on. I just get these notices that say, you are demonetized, and I just kind of go, oh.
Yeah, they're just trying to punish, you, right, for...
Check. Check.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Now, you know that awards can be purchased, right?
So can PhDs.
There you go.
Charles, I cut you off. What were you saying?
I was going to say I enjoyed your clip from your glory days when you got this close to rock and roll glory.
Oh, you mean the Salvador Dream someday music will be on the internet thing or
yeah, and also you had a clip of when you said when you had hair, which I can relate to.
Yeah.
Well, hey, listen, I don't know. I'm very interested in what you guys want to talk about, but I just have done my best to talk about these vaccine ID cards and how that thing is just an operational mess, you know. But, you know, network state, always an evergreen topic. Or, Jesse, if you want to dive into how software isn't going to be unbiased.
Let me throw in a quick introduction. Welcome one and all to the Access of Easy Salon number 33. Charles Hugh Smith is back in the saddle. Jesse Hirsch is here from the Ottawa Valley, and I am Mark Cheftovic, and the date is December 3rd, home stretch to the end of 2020.
Yeah, which is, I think, in the long view will simply be the preliminary warm-up. We're not even in inning one yet, to use a baseball analogy. We just went through the warm-up, you know, so... Everybody thinks this is the ninth inning. No, not even close. We're just getting started on inning one. That's 2021. That's my view.
I really hope you're wrong. Positive view. Yes, that's you know what the computer programmers say: arrays start at zero, not one.
I'm of the position that time is relative. Lunchtime, doubly so.
Yeah, nothing like the pangs of hunger. Well, I don't know when we're going to start rolling, but I'd
oh,
like...
Oh, we're already rolling.
Charles, you know we're always rolling, right? It's
yeah, exactly.
Society here. Come on.
No, I'd like to see what you guys think about the whole issue of issuing vaccine passports or vaccine ID cards to solve all of our problems and go back to wonderful 2019.
Well, it's hard not to subscribe to the many conspiracy theories that are going around when you see this kind of initiative. I mean, one of the things that has struck me about this, and I wrote it up a couple times in Access of Easy, is that it's interesting that when you hear a government spokesperson talking about this, or somebody puts the question directly to a government representative, they say, oh no, vaccines aren't going to be mandatory. That would be wrong or whatever, or some variation of that. And yet, they are going to end up being de facto mandatory because the rules are being set by quasi-monopolies in their space, like Ticketmaster and your national airline and your kid's school, and they're all going to just decide, yeah, we're not going to interact with you if you don't have a vaccination. So this is going to be mandatory. And then tracking it, I have been talking to a few people here in Canada where we have universal health care, but things like vaccination records are completely, I don't even want to use the word decentralized. It's a filing cabinet in the doctor's office is where your vaccine records are. So we are going to have to, in this country at least, build out an entire infrastructure to enforce this. And I will use the word enforce, that we have our immunity passports in proper order before we could even re-enter society.
Jesse, what do you make of this issue?
Are you on mute?
I think you're muted.
Ironically, what I said was I have nothing to say on this issue. I muted because my phone was ringing and I didn't want the ring to, you know, be part of the audio. But if this is something you guys feel compelled to talk about, I'll sit back while the two of you guys talk about it. And when you're done, I'll chime in.
Okay. Well,
about a different subject.
Right. Okay. Well, what I think is interesting, there's a couple of different angles here, which I think are operational. In other words, I see the sort of abstraction here, like everybody goes, okay, what's the solution? Vaccines are the solution. And how does that work? If 70 to 100% of the people are vaccinated, then we can go back to normal and it will all be great. And so that's our goal. So we're going to make it happen. Carrot, stick, you know, whatever. And but operationally, like what Mark was speaking about, exactly how are the records going to be kept secure? You know, and so there's an article in CNN today here about the U.S. and it's so funny because the images about these test kits and the dummied up vaccine card are from the Department of Defense, their DOD. And so it's all like, well, that's interesting, because I was wondering what organization has the capability to do this. In other words, and they're saying, well, here in the States, your state Department of Health is going to get a digital record of every vaccine. And I'm thinking, you mean the state systems that are still running COBOL and they're hiring 68-year-old people to try to come on and keep it from crashing? Like, you know, and so it's like people have no idea how kludgy most government systems are, right? And so now we're going to keep hundreds of millions of records and they're all going to be secure from hackers. But that's number one. Number two, no one knows how long the vaccines are going to endure, right? Be functional. So you get your vaccine card, and some people will still have antibodies present in 10 months. Some won't. Well, how the hell are we supposed to know? So what good is the card? Then there's the issue of, let's say that there's a, you know, a mink catches it, and there's a mutation of a new protein spike that bypasses or evades the vaccine binding agents. And so then it's all like, oh, well then what good is this card against this new strain, you know? And so I'm also thinking like, you know, there's just a lot of holes in this whole thing. I mean, so how are you gonna make it happen?
Here's the thing, Charles. I have very little time that I get to spend with you and your brilliance and your wisdom and knowledge. And given that you're sharing with me a story that has a lot of holes in it, which I don't disagree with you, that has a lot of holes in it, what point is there in amplifying that story? And without getting into it, I'll bring it back to the original frame. I think it's totally ludicrous that there is such a thing as returning to normal. And I think the idea that we would go back to any world that pre-existed the pandemic is just impossible, because time travel, as we know it, at least as I know it, is impossible. We're only moving forward into the future. Economically, you've spoken often about the teetering nature of the economy as we know it, and the fact that it can't continue with the fabric of lies that it's used to sell financialization and to create the global market as we know it. So if we collectively agree that there's no way going back to where we were, let's not give any credibility to the forces, whether in the state or otherwise, that are suggesting we are, right? Because the idea that a vaccine or anything else is going to bring us back to normal, like, we all know that's ludicrous. So let's not waste our modest time together indulging in such ludicrous fantasies. Let us instead talk about the world we currently live in, or the world that we think we're headed to, Because I think we can all agree it ain't going to be the normal that used to be, right?
But
yeah,
I see
a very good point.
I understand the point, but there's a couple of things. Like, one, it's kind of the elephant in the room. So, and then
I need you to substantiate that. What do you mean that it's the elephant in the room?
Well, this entire episode has defined our entire lives of the entire planet for the entire year. And
sorry, which episode? Oh, the pandemic, you mean?
Yes. And so, okay. And so the virus, or sorry, the vaccine is being tooted. It's interesting.
Tooted by
that,
whom?
Hang on. It's interesting that whether you choose back to normal as a phantasm that isn't going to happen, or a new normal, because I get mixed messages. Like, you say politicians are promising us that we'll go back to normal, and I'm saying, show me the politicians who are promising we're going to go back to normal, because every talking head, whenever I can turn on the TV for any amount of time, is saying normal is gone. The new normal is here. And the new normal means, you
so,
know,
since
just hang on.
Me, I never said politicians.
Okay.
Right? I mean, if anything, what I'm reacting to is you is if I were to use your language for a moment. You guys are responding to a media narrative because the media has fixated on vaccines and has decided that vaccines are a path out of the pandemic. And I'm saying I don't want to spend my limited time with you wise gentlemen talking about what the media talks about, because I don't watch the media and I'm not interested in the media. I would rather spend our limited time together talking about what we are interested in, which is not bullshit media narratives coming from a bullshit media industry. Correct me if you think I'm phrasing that incorrectly.
Well, you're not wrong, but coming back to elephants in the room, that's another one, because the media, I mean, I've been trying to articulate this all year, the media is a cancer. Like, it defines everything. It defines reality. And if you go against what the media says is reality, you get your career destroyed, you get marginalized, you get deplatformed. So it's one thing to say the media is full of shit, let's not even talk about them, but yet every aspect of our lives is boundaried by the narratives that the media decides are true.
So I think that's a fascinating discussion. I disagree with you 100%, but I think it's a very valid discussion for us to have on, say, the influence of the media, the influence of social media, the establishment of norms as kind of unwritten cultural laws that govern, like, all of that, I think, is what we should be talking about. What I don't think we should be talking about is the actual narratives that media creates. Do you understand the distinction?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess let me notch the discussion forward one step, at least attempt to do so, by saying, I think listening to you, Jesse, I think I've now clarified what I found interesting in this whole, you know, vaccine ID card thing, which is common sense used to be a norm and now it is not. Because I just sort of went through this very common sense thing. Okay, how is this going to work? Just asking from an outsider's point of view, just common sense stuff. And then that's not being reflected in the media.
Although I'd push back and say that your common sense is not common. Right? Like, and I only say this because you are an exceptionally intelligent individual, Charles. If no one's told you that in your life, allow me to be the first. And where in a previous episode, you sort of argued that the public education system in the United States has failed. Therefore, I might conclude that not everybody has your level of intellect, Charles. And therefore, not everyone exercises the same level of common sense as you do. But otherwise, I would generally agree with you that common sense does seem to be a little scarce in terms of our world and the way in which it is practiced.
It's not just that common sense is scarce. It goes back to the recurring theme of hyper-normalization that we've talked about so many times, where you're just expected to buy into an absurd narrative. And it's not only can you dispute the narrative, it's if you don't believe this absurd narrative fervently enough, then there's something wrong with you, and you pay the price for it. And it's really
and my argument, and I agree with you, and my argument is that that narrative is actually a distraction. That we live in a world where all the world's knowledge is at our fingertips. We have such incredible freedoms to explore and say different things. And what makes those narratives so toxic, so enmeshing, is that they're not just flawed. They're traps. They're designed to distract us from the real conversations, the real pursuits of knowledge, the real engagement that we could be having. And that's why I get so frustrated by them. Because I'm like, there's so many other things we could be talking about. And like vaccines in particular, to take that as an example, it's totally thrown out there so that we don't focus on all the other shit going on in terms of this pandemic. Because the pandemic is a shit show. And we should be talking about the elements of the shit show. And I just find the vaccine is like a distraction. It's like candy that gets people locked in an insular, self-reinforcing narrative. When, you know, we could be talking about other things like Amazon and the pharmacy business, which I think is more relevant than, say, what Big Pharma is doing to develop vaccines. But I digress.
Can I jump in for one quick second, Charles? I guess that's a yes. So what I think, I agree with everything you were saying, and I think I've talked about it a couple times in previous episodes, that like for my own sanity, I had to make a intentional, deliberate effort to start tuning out narrative. I changed my routine. I'm hardly on social media at all. I'm just, my time is scarce, and how do I use my time? And I'm actually finding I'm being a lot more productive with my time now that I'm not getting caught up in this. However, and I don't mean to bring it back in, but there still is the reality, right, that these vaccines are coming that have been rushed out, and then it's easy enough to say, it's all a distractive and it's a shit show. It's all a distraction and it's a shit show and we shouldn't waste time on it. But at the end of the day, I have to decide, okay, well, if I don't get my child vaccinated, she's not going to be allowed to go back in school. That's a real world thing that, you know, and everybody, every one of us is going to have to make a real world decision about that kind of thing. And that's why it's easier said than done to say, it's all a crazy narrative that's taking our time away, but yet it's this looming obstacle in front of every single one of our lives that we have to make this health decision for ourselves and our families with imperfect information and so, completely skewed information filters.
So allow me to just role play as the radical for a moment, because normally that's your job. You should be taking your kid out of school anyway, because education's fun. Secondly, forget about the health of vaccines. What about the health of the food you eat? I mean, do you actually look at the way in which food is produced and how rapidly that stuff is thrown out there? So I agree, everything you just said about vaccines is totally valid. But if we roll it back to bigger questions about how do we learn and what do we put in our bodies, then all kids should get out of school right now, and schools as we know it should be burnt, and the education system as we know it should be totally redesigned from the ground up. And everything we eat is junk. We got to look at the agricultural sector and the food we produce, because, oh my God, is it atrocious, and yada, yada, yada. And we could spend hours and hours and hours talking about just education and food, and we would get to far more substantial issues than anything we would touch with the vaccine. And we could throw in work, too, if because it's not just school, right? It's work, that some people won't be able to go to work because of the whole vaccine stuff, right? So jobs suck. Get rid of jobs, get rid of work, right? I'm just saying, if we want to talk about the substance of these issues, it's much bigger than pandemics and vaccines, which I hope I've teed you up, Charles, in a way that speaks to your larger narrative.
Well, yeah, and I was actually feeling kind of guilty that I just jumped in with my, you know, vaccine ID card narrative. And so you guys each should have an opportunity to say what you want to talk about today.
Well, I actually, not what I want to talk about. What I want to hear you guys talk about is Bitcoin. Because, you know, we've touched upon it in the past and it just hit a new high. So I still want to hear from you guys who know more about economics and monetary theory than I do. What's going on up there?
Okay.
Mark,
did you have
a topic you wanted to nail today?
I'm happy to talk about Bitcoin and cryptos in general. Obviously, this isn't the kind of show where we say, well, we think Bitcoin's going to $100,000 or anything like that. We're more, I think, on the under
I'm a skeptic.
Yeah. I've been doing, I've been starting to read up more about Ethereum 2 and their change to the new upgrade for the new blockchain. And as I'm reading through this report on Messari, it's actually a free report. I'll put it in the show notes. Just get on their mailing list. It's like 47 pages long. I go through it and I'm like, this is Klein. This is decentralization. This is participatory government in here. And I guess for me, I know it's back in the conscious mind because of the price action, but for me, it's just another confirmation that cryptocurrency, decentralization, blockchain, smart contracts, this really has been a game changer. It really is a ray of hope for me because it is, okay, you know what? As this ossified institutional society kind of starts to wither and crumble, as I think we're seeing happen in front of our very eyes, there will be these new institutions that spring into its place and start providing some of this functionality. I've also been keeping track of health technology companies and how some companies are sort of putting the two together. So there's some cautious optimism there that, you know, institutions have failed us on every level all over the world. And then there's this little, comparatively little movement of crypto. Bitcoin, I think, is serves one purpose that's very important, and I think it's doing a good job. And Ethereum serves a completely different purpose, and it does a good job. And then there's all these other millions of other projects, which I think are a good thing, not a bad thing, from some of the maximalists. And overall, that's one of the few areas in my life where I'm actually experiencing a little bit of optimism and starting to try and spend more time getting up to speed on it. Because the first sort of wave from 2015 to 17, 18, call it, I got involved a little bit with the Ethereum name service project and stuff like that, but I didn't really dive right in. And this time I'm looking at it thinking I might want to be more involved. I might want to have a better understanding of the technology than I did in the last few years. And yeah, it's one of the rays of sunshine in all this.
Yeah, and I agree. And I guess, Jesse, thank you. It was nice of you to ask us. And of course, the field is changing much faster than I can keep track of, frankly. So I'm kind of just looking at the abstractions. And I want to speak to something that, Jesse, you brought up in one of our previous conversations, which is the whole idea here of the future we want is things are democratized. In other words, money is democratized. And governance, or you know, agency, the work we choose, all that stuff is democratized as opposed to authoritarian hierarchical structures. And so, I think that the hit for me on Bitcoin, and I wrote about Bitcoin, you know, back in 2016 when I really started to understand it as a form of money. It's not democratized. It's wealthy people buying Bitcoin. Wealthy institutions are buying Bitcoin, you know, and it's all like, oh, so it's just going to be like gold. 99% of the people will own none. 0.9% will own a tiny bit. And then the vast majority are going to be held by whales, you know. And so it's like, well, wait a minute, that's not the innovation we want. That's okay as a step, but we want to democratize it. And so when I hear Mark talking about Ethereum too, the lights are going off going, well, this is how it's going to really make a difference in the world, is it can democratize the things we care about, work, money, agency. And I guess I want to make a little technical comment here, and I'm not an expert, but blockchain as instantiated by Bitcoin is, you know, as we all know, it's a huge sink of energy. You know, it requires a lot of duplication and stuff like that. And there's cryptocurrencies that don't require that exact protocol. And so the hit on Bitcoin has been for years, well, that's just a big energy suck, you know, suck. And so it's unaffordable. It's going to crash the world's electrical consumption and all that kind of stuff. And it's just, well, wait a minute, that's only one model. There's other models that are much more energy efficient. And I think the other thing I want to mention that I'm excited about is the potential for just a really cheap $15 smartphone in India or China being able to function, you know, in a this kind of alternative system we're talking about. In other words, you don't need a lot of powerful computing to access this stuff any more than, you know, the commercialization of digital payments in China, for example. I mean, I see that as kind of a model for how these alternative systems could work. And then one last comment is, it's all about obsoleting stuff that doesn't work well. And so then we go back to Jesse and the whole concept that what's obsolete gets expanded at first, right? And that's kind of where we're at, you know?
Well, not even at first, kind of in perpetuity, right? That when something becomes obsolete, it proliferates, because if something is worthless, it's because it's in great quantity, right, in terms of market dynamics. And, you know, where I think I share Mark's optimism, or, you know, cautious enthusiasm, to mix the phrase, in terms of Ethereum, is the idea that it is this big, great big computer, right? That you're making more of the economy configurable, which is, at least I believe, a potential democratizing force. And the other thing that I've always appreciated about Bitcoin, appreciated about Ethereum, appreciated about cryptocurrency, is it's fostering literacy, right? It's teaching people about monetary policy, which is something that used to be deliberately obscure and elitist, but is now becoming open source and participatory. And that, I think, in and of itself is a positive development. And so where I'm a little, not hesitant, but suspicious, I guess, skeptical at the growing power of Bitcoin, because it is basically a bunch of whales, and I don't like a system that just replaces one set of whales with another set of whales. And how do we know they're even different whales? For all we know, they're the same whale. And yet, there's a part of me that likes the opportunity that there's increased transparency, increased potential programming, and a new opportunity to configure. And configure a system when more people are aware of how that system works. And when the literacy of that system is more open and accessible to anyone who wants to bother to learn it. You know, the next step is for a smart regulatory policy. And I don't expect that to come from governments, but I could see that coming from, for lack of a romantic word, the forces of democracy. That if the forces of democracy were to anticipate what the cryptocurrency configuration should be to really foster a democratic society, and I think Climb is one iteration, right? I think in order for there to be a true debate, we need comparison and contrast. So we need some other intellectuals to step up and make their own proposals so that we can have an actual debate. But that's what gives me hope in terms of seeing these systems and seeing a positive opportunity when it comes to a decentralized or distributed society.
A couple things quickly on the energy front. Ethereum 2 is moving to from proof of work to proof of stake. So that takes the whole energy drain issue off the table, and that was one of their objectives, was to create a blockchain that's not going to be a big energy sink. The other thing on the Bitcoin front, I wish I bookmarked it or kept it, but I saw a stat the other day about how much percentage of Bitcoin power is estimated to come from renewables, and it was a big number. Like, I couldn't believe the number, especially since most of the hash power is in China. I found the number really hard to believe, but it did kind of hearten me, because it was a big enough number that I thought, okay, there's actually some kind of momentum within this space to use renewables or something to make this cleaner. But
it's hydroelectric.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I suppose. Yeah. That would explain.
That's what we got here in Ontario, Quebec, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of Bitcoin farming in Quebec, because they're extending incentives.
And China's big time hydroelectric.
There is that. So yeah. So I think the statistic I saw was 70%. Of the hash power was generated from renewables, which was mind-blowing. But one of the things that some of the the critics of cryptocurrencies always argue, I think is one of the, it's not a bug, it's a feature. They say, well, anybody can make a cryptocurrency. I'm like, well, what's wrong with that? Oh, there's 10 million cryptocurrencies. Yeah, so what? And the ones that actually demonstrate value and get momentum will do that. I mean, that's democracy and consensus in action. So that's how it's supposed to work. Now, we live in a world where you need a permit to open a hot dog stand and you get fined for collecting rainwater. You know, I'm being extreme, Jesse. Don't worry about it. But
well, you know the story of the barbecue place. That's why I was wondering if you were being specific.
No, I forgot all about that, actually. And so, so anybody can fork the Bitcoin source and run off and do their own thing. Well, let them. And so I've been actually looking at a Bitcoin fork called Ravencoin, which is layering additional tokenization properties on top of Bitcoin. And I'm like, more power to them. This is great. This is what we want to see happen. And governance, and I'm sorry, I'm going to get the name wrong probably, but I wrote an article about Ethereum name service governance a few years ago, and I got an email from someone who is either Dash or Zcash. I can't remember who, and I'm sorry, apologies to whoever it wasn't or was, but they said, you know, here's a whole governance model that we have on our blockchain, and it's like, take a look at it because we think it's pretty coherent. And then again, reading through the governance model on Ethereum too, it's like they are, it reminded me of one of Charles's early books where he says, if the system, what the system optimizes, the system gets. So if the system optimizes for corruption, the system gets corruption. And so the Ethereum developers, they know this. And so they're saying, okay, what we want to do is we want to make it expensive to game the system, and we want to make it inexpensive to cut out the gaming of the thing. And they call it slashing, right? They want to make it inexpensive to slash, and we want to make it expensive to cheat. And so again, it's what do you optimize for is what you get. Well, they're optimizing for being able to excise corruption. And so that's what I am hopeful they're going to succeed in achieving.
You know, it's interesting, Jesse, you mentioned regulation, and I guess I'm thinking that the CLIMB system is like specifically for work and money. It's like the idea was connecting like gainful work with some sort of community, you know, value, and then you get paid for it with something that you can use in your life, right? And so, but I think there's also maybe, you know, the starting programs might be like regulatory networks about, like, say, environmental pollution or something. Like anybody with a smartphone could post water quality that they sampled at some bay, right? And then post it to an Ethereum 2 kind of system. And then there would be sort of a crowdsourced regulatory structure, like, hey, there's a source of pollution here, and we've identified it by, you know, people testing the bay in their areas, and it's all like, oh, it turns out it's that paper plant or something along those lines. So again, governance, if we talk about the network state, I can discern the potential for like distributed regulatory structures as opposed to some extremely hierarchical thing where you have to go to the federal government to get, you know, some kind of oversight and blah blah blah, and it's like, why don't we just start doing it ourselves? And I think that's the other promise of these kinds of open governance systems.
I mean, the question is, who does it for themselves, and which issues are done for themselves? And I mean, I think the culture is maturing, that those crowdsourced initiatives are becoming a little more self-evident, that there's more of an awareness amongst communities that they can do these things on their own, that they don't have to ask for permission, that the tools are available, you know, for that to happen. But there still, I think, is a role for, whether it's education, whether it's inspiration, whether it's best practices, whether it's guidance. So I think it's worth imagining what form that takes in a decentralized world, you know, and how that manifests. I don't have the answer to that. I'm just sort of wondering, but it just strikes me as there's a potential role there in terms of what you just described, in terms of how that deregulated or decentralized form of regulation starts to emerge. So on the one hand, it's not vigilantism, right? It's not NIMBYism. It's not people saying we don't want this in our backyard, but it's instead cooperative and transparent and open, so that it still focuses on virtues like the greater good or the public interest, which is part of what the state at least tries to just doesn't obviously doesn't always accomplish. But part of the state's justification is that it speaks for everybody and not just some people. So how do we replicate that? How do we find the equivalent of that in a stateless, decentralized society?
For one thing, we have to be in a stateless society, because one of the things you said was that these decentralized initiatives will be able to start doing this without permission or seeking permission. And I thought, yes, they will, because this will only be able to emerge, this is what I worry, it will only be able to emerge when the state disintegrates to the point where it's leaving a vacuum that it can emerge into. If it tries to emerge ahead of that time, I mean, let's face it, you might push back on this statement, but the reality is for 2020, we entered a world where that which is not expressly permitted is forbidden across the board. So that's the world we live in now. So now someone's going to say, this is a decentralized initiative to democratize access to X. And the state is going to say, you can't do that. Where's your permit? Where's the legislation that permits that?
See, I think that's your world. I think that's the world you're imagining. Because in the world that I live in, a jerk can open a barbecue restaurant for 4 years without a license, without complying with health regulations, and the fines he's levied are so tiny that they don't impinge his ability to operate his business at all. And that's not an isolated incident. So, you know, the idea that the state has to collapse before decentralization is possible is ludicrous. I think what's more likely is that the state is presently ineffective, and it's not actually able to stop the use of narcotics, the selling of sex, the practice of gambling, or a jerk opening up a barbecue restaurant in Toronto. Like, you can do whatever you want in the world we currently live in. Yes, you will get into trouble for some things, often arbitrary things, which is frustrating because you don't always know what you're going to get in trouble for. I hear you. And if you want, we can have a conversation about that. But the world we live in right now, people do whatever the fuck they want all the time. Go on to social media. You'll find an endless supply of examples of that. People saying stuff they're not supposed to say, doing stuff they're not supposed to do, like, you name it. So I understand the general argument you're making, but I will push back and say that the decentralized world is possible right now. You just got to do it. And in many cases, the state does not have the capability to stop it. And when they do try to stop it, it'll just be proof that they can't stop it. And the example I will cite to you is something called the Streisand effect. So all I'm suggesting is we live in a world where these things are already happening. But I acknowledge your point that the arbitrary enforcement of arbitrary rules by arbitrary powers is another thing that's also happening, and it's frustrating.
Charles, were you about to say something?
No, go ahead, Mark.
Well, I mean, we could argue this back and forth all day long. I see your point, but the world that we entered this year, more so than in past years, is literally rule by edict, right? All businesses close, except whichever ones are on this list can open. Yes, the guy opened his restaurant. He was also taken away in handcuffs. So, you know, I've been working with other people.
But he's not still in jail, right?
I don't know. I haven't. To be
he's
honest,
still
I
in jail.
I haven't really been
he's
following
made
$300,000
in a decentralized funding campaign. So I agree with you that the world we are currently living in is different. But I disagree with you that the state has any power in it. Because all I see is a state that is incompetent, flailing, unable to manage anything, let alone vaccines, let alone, like, immunity. Like, this is what I'm saying. the world around us is falling apart, and you keep wanting to ascribe to it a power it doesn't have. That's all I'm disagreeing with.
Look, you know, maybe when it gets serious, the state's power is not to be underestimated. Okay, I mean, I'm...
For those of you listening just on audio, at this point, I told a story about the power of the state, which I realized during editing is pursuant to a gag order, so I deleted it.
It's so one thing I agree with you 100%, never underestimate the power of the state. Never underestimate an organization that claims a monopoly on violence. Because any organization that claims a monopoly on violence means that they use it, and they use it a lot. I don't disagree. What I'm suggesting is they don't have the resources to get all of us. If everybody starts doing decentralized stuff, there's nothing they can do to stop it.
You're going to hate what I say next, okay? Everybody is not going to start doing decentralized stuff, because at some point, the mainstream media will just turn up the loudspeakers and the shriek-o-meter, and they'll say, decentralization is racist. And suddenly, it'll be stigma to do something decentralized.
Why do you think I keep giving you guys shit for tuning into the mainstream media?
My point is that
everyone should tune it out. When they try to do that, we won't hear them.
We're not everyone, and the people who watch this show aren't everyone, but we all have to live in a society with everyone who sits in a bar with CNN. Well, they don't sit in bars anymore, but they sit at home with CNN on a 75-inch TV all day long, and they think that what that's telling them is reality.
Dude, why do you think Charles and I live where we live? Get with the program. If you don't feel safe around the people you live around, get the F out of Dodge.
It's not that I don't feel safe around those people. I mean, it's just that we live among people who are followers.
Do you want me to tell you about the people who live around me?
Well, I'm sure
I can tell you they're armed. I can tell you that, you know, they don't believe in government. I can tell you that if anyone enters their property, they have dogs and other things that go nuts. So quite frankly, I'm really not scared of the government. I'm really not scared. You know, like, this is what I'm saying. Charles lives in Hawaii, and while it is part of the United States of America, I suspect there's a lot of people in Hawaii who would be perfectly happy to be independent if America were to implode and start falling apart. So, like, I understand your analysis, Mark. I agree with the contextual part of it. But I'm also saying, if you don't trust your neighbors, move.
You know, that brings up an interesting part of, to me, this one of the contexts in this whole discussion is this, Jesse, you mentioned the common good. And of course, Mark's discussion of Ethereum 2 is part of that. In other words, we're recognizing this has the potential to really serve the common good, right? And in my view, I think one of the roadblocks to serving the common good is it requires some sacrifice. And I think that that's part of what centralized government has made it so easy. You know, in other words, we're going to send you a payment, you're going to get free money, and we're going to provide the food bank and blah, blah, blah. And so it's all like, oh, all I have to do is kind of passively show up or open my account and I've got free money. And so there's no sacrifice required. And I guess that's part of the corruption that's eaten away the civic virtue, if you will. So I think part of decentralization is there has to be a reward or a virtue benefit sufficient enough for people to go, I'm gonna opt into this, and it's gonna require some effort, or I'm gonna have to sacrifice something, even if it's my free time or something, in order to contribute to this. And if we can't get that far, then I think the society is beyond saving, you know, and that's possible.
Although new societies emerge,
right?
And that was my, I for the record, even though it's too late, I was being facetious earlier when I said, like, burn down all the schools and get rid of work and change the food supply, because such radical change would be difficult. But the point of, you know, when a society ends, new societies emerge, there's a million ways we could be educating our kids. Right? There's a million ways in which we could be organizing adults to you know, manage society around work. We do the one we do because it's the one we all found ourselves in, because it's the one that has sort of evolved over the last several decades and couple of centuries. You know, part of what I learned from you, Mark, that I think not a lot of people have a literacy about is our monetary system doesn't have to be the way it is. And that part of the nature of our current monetary system is it's rigged, that it benefits a very small amount of people and makes it near impossible for everybody else to kind of get ahead, right? So that's where we started saying, maybe we need a new society, right? Maybe we need a new way of doing this. And I understand, Mark, your frustration with the mainstream media and thinking that a decentralized society is something that most people can't imagine. But there's only one way to change that, right? And that's partly what we're doing, which is putting out different kind of media. But it's why I say, turn off the mainstream media. Don't listen to it. Tell other people, don't listen to it. Turn it off completely, because it is a narcotic. And it's meant to keep you intoxicated. It's meant to keep you hooked. It's meant to keep you distracted. And we live in an age where the internet is like, so every night for me on an entertainment level, I turn to YouTube or I turn to Twitch because I want to find other people. I want to find unique voices. I want to find, in a decentralized world, other people saying stuff I've never heard before. And I love it. It's so invigorating. It's so fulfilling. I wish it wasn't owned by Google. I wish it wasn't owned by Amazon. I do, for the record, try to go to, you know, less frequented places. But there's power in the platform. There's power in the mass. There's power in the common in terms of having everyone there together. And that's why I'm so interested in our conversations around how do we imagine a decentralized society based on protocols rather than platforms that allows for this type of agora, allows for this type of, you know, diversity of voices. And so the mainstream media doesn't matter anymore. What they have to say doesn't matter. The narratives they peddle don't matter. And instead, we get totally new narratives.
Yeah, and let me just add to that is I think one of the triggers or, you know, motivators will be when people look at the money that they, the cryptocurrency they own, whatever variety it is, and they realize it's holding its value better than the government currency that they're getting either for pay or social benefits or whatever. I think something like that where, wow, I can see the benefit in this other system, you know, or the shelves are empty at the corporate store, and yet the community food banks got a lot of stuff being given by people who have too much, and hey, I can go there, you know. So I guess it's that point of the benefit and the sacrifice, you know, kind of I don't know how to say it. They're it kind of encouraging, or there's a feedback loop that's self-sustaining.
Yeah, imagine
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Imagine a world where your cost of living went down over time instead of up. It would change everything. And again, that comes back to the monetary system. It comes back to deflation versus inflation, elastic versus inelastic money.
Well, and imagine a world where people in poverty actually had a path out of it, right? Imagine a world in which someone who is, you know, working class actually had a legitimate opportunity to become middle class, you know, which is not asking a lot, but that's not possible in our current world. And that's part of the problem.
I'm seeing rays of hope with the whole DeFi movement and what, and actually they're going straight to the world's unbanked, and they are using those cheap smartphones and suddenly getting access to financial services and abilities that they didn't even have a bank account in the past. And now they're able to just leapfrog over that, what's now a parasitic institution, really, and just get straight to, okay, I want to be able to conduct business and finance and even on whatever scale I'm operating at without this middleman nickel and diming me for every, you know, getting in the middle of every single transaction that I'm trying to do.
Yeah, that brings up one of the contexts I've been kind of thinking more about, which is what's part of what's wrong with the current system is the balance between labor and capital has completely, you know, been skewed for It's been accelerating in the last 20 years. So capital has all the advantages, right, in the system. And in terms of wealth and income, and then it uses that to buy political power. And so part of why it's so hard for a working class person to become so-called middle class or have, you know, enhance their security is their access to capital is so constrained, right? And this is the, so if we're going to look at like, okay, how do we rebalance capital and labor such that a person that only has labor to sell can acquire capital? And by capital, I don't mean just money. I mean, to Jesse's point, knowledge, right, that can be turned into productivity and you know, social capital and all that. It's like we lost Mark. So I think that's the hope here of this decentralized and the leverage provided by cryptocurrencies and blockchain is that we can create new forms of capital that are democratized. That's how I would put it.
One big union. And as one big union uses, instead of using Facebook as a way to organize people to buy shit they don't need, he uses Facebook as a way to help them leverage collective power, to help them negotiate better wages from their employers, to help them negotiate for things like health benefits, right? Because the whole point of a platform like Facebook is it creates collectivity, it creates collective power. Right now, it marshals that collective power to advertisers because it allows advertisers to access those collectives. There's no reason why Facebook couldn't decide tomorrow that it was going to be a union and it was going to mobilize that collective power to increasing the, you know, the wages and the conditions of the working class. Not to be ludicrous or surrealist, but it is within the realm of possibility. And Mark, that's where I'll also say I've been recording this. So okay. Even though you disconnected, I can send you a clip of what I recorded here, and in theory, you could patch it into your recording.
Good, because I lost you guys when Charles was talking about no access to capital, and we came back in when you were talking about Facebook. So
it's a communist conspiracy that as soon as we started talking about the need for labor to organize, the capitalist was kicked out of the room temporarily until our secret coup was, you know, settled. Yes. And then you were readmitted.
Fabianism. Yeah.
Well, you know, Mark, in terms of the sort of anarcho-capitalism that you've espoused, the idea being how difficult is it? How many roadblocks are there to accessing capital, social, intellectual, and financial, real-world capital? And I see that the flaw in the current system can be sort of summarized as there's so many barriers the average person has a very tenuous hold on any capital, right? And so, because the cartels and monopolies in the state have basically, you know, optimized those with capital to increase their capital, right? So, I was basically saying that blockchain and cryptocurrencies are a way of enabling the optimization of democratizing access to capital. And so, and then Jesse's point was that the platforms and protocols as well, anything that would collectively put together a common interest that could be pursued against other powerful interests would be, you know, extremely politically powerful. And so that's an interesting, that's another interesting thing of cryptocurrencies and blockchains. What if everybody that used Ethereum 2 was able to put some sort of collective effort politically into force, right? So,
well, yeah. They are presently, both in their attention and time and in terms of their financial resources if they're investing. But, you know, the next step would then be for them to form like a political action committee, right? The next step would be to not just be isolated on their own, but say, you know, we need to write our rules. We need to make sure we're the ones setting the policies. We need to engage the state so that the state serves our interests rather than, say, Wall Street's interests or whatever the case may be. Not that I'm suggesting Wall Street and cryptocurrency are at odds with each other. As far as I'm concerned, they're all on the same side. They just might be disagreeing on methodology. But I digress.
I mean, that just sounds, in a sense, maybe it's the cynic in me of just joining in the fray that everyone else is playing. Let's form a political action committee. Let's form a lobby. Let's just go to Washington and buy our way into the kind of legislation we want. And that's the playing the game.
Well, I mean, half of that is right. Yes, I was saying play the game. The game is democracy. Now, democracy as it's currently constructed is not the democracy I want. But that doesn't mean I'm going to violently overthrow it. Right? And it also doesn't mean I'm going to stoop to the depths or, you know, get dirty in the grease or whatever. Like, I would still take the virtuous path. But political action is still required. And collective political action is still required. It would just have to be, you know, of living to the values that group, at least, I'll be myself, that I would believe in, like transparency and openness and decentralization and participation. So the Ethereum pack or the cryptocurrency pack could be governed by a cryptocurrency, right? Could have its own voting system. Like, there's no reason why you have to play the game the way the other guys play the game. But if the game is democracy, well, then damn straight, of course you got to play the game.
Yeah, there was a big study a couple of years ago. I'm sure you guys saw it. It was in the U.S. where somebody went and looked at the way Congress votes, and they basically tallied whose interests were being served, and they basically concluded that the public was not served at all. In other words,
I remember that
what
study?
The public,
yeah,
yeah, it was the public was simply ignored, and so I think that's to Jesse's point. I think that we're trying to weave our way between those extremes of being powerless, completely powerless and voiceless, except at sort of like fake elections.
And also, let's not forget, the United States isn't a democracy, right? It's a republic.
If right. you can keep it.
Yeah, but I think it's very interesting to consider the collective power of cryptocurrencies and blockchains. That's kind of like what we're talking about, is if a million crypto users suddenly protested some restriction on cryptocurrency use, that would be impressive to people
And to be clear, I'm not suggesting that their opportunity is to protest, because I think protesting, at least in our contemporary fashion, is not the most effective means. I think the opportunity for cryptocurrency people is just to write the fucking law, right? Like, they don't need to protest, they just need to move forward. No one there has a clue. If they show them the roadmap to American prosperity, America will get on that bus so quick, right? If they were to give them a roadmap to, you know, mitigating Chinese supremacy, they would get on that road so quick. So it's when I say political action committee, I really mean leadership. I mean, like, step up, use your intellect, use your smarts, use your vision of a future to offer people a better future. And if they support it, then there you go. You win the game.
What, you mean enter politics?
No, I mean enter society. Politics is a subset of society.
I like your idea of leadership and offering people a better future. That's what it really boils down to. And then everyone, as you say, everyone will jump on. And that's the potential of cryptocurrencies and, you know, blockchain. So, and I think that's a pretty good point to end on myself.
I know. Do too. I think so. Any closing remarks, Jesse?
No, other than, you know, I recall at the Toronto Bitcoin Summit.
Yes.
Remember what year that was?
2016, I believe. 15
okay.
or 16. 15.
Fair
2015.
Enough. It feels like a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
But I remember charging people one Bitcoin to enter the conference.
Yeah.
And like, man, if I had those Bitcoins today.
Yeah, what'd you do? Spend it on a pizza later? Or
I think I gave a lot of them to you, quite frankly.
Oh, yeah.
And I spent them on domain names. So good on you for that win.
And we hodled until
expensive domain names.
We hodled until like December 2017. Anyhow, go on.
The truth of all this is I would not have those Bitcoins today, even if I didn't spend them. Because where would I have kept those Bitcoins, right? Would I have kept them on, what was that brokerage that got hacked?
Quadriga?
I don't know. There's too many to count.
Yeah. Oh, right? The one that got hacked was...
Mt. Gox?
Well, they went bankrupt.
Yeah. All I'm saying is...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they did.
There's a lot of places I could have left them in which they would have disappeared. I could have kept them on a computer of mine that probably would have been hacked. And there's no way I would have done an air-gapped machine or, you know, some other equally sophisticated OPSEC solution because I'm lazy and stupid as fuck. So even though I had those Bitcoins, I resigned myself to saying, even if I had not spent them on domain names that I'm happy to have spent them on, I still probably wouldn't have them today. And I'm okay with that.
Well, you know what they say, not your keys, not your coins. Actually, we'll close off in a sec, but a buddy of mine who's not really super technologically proficient, but he was saying, yeah, you know, I used to have Bitcoin, and I think I had Ethereum and Litecoin, and I lost it all on that Quadriga CX. I just, you know, that it all went away, and, you know, I had moved it onto my wallet, and next thing I know, it's gone away. And I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. What did you just say? He said, well, I moved it onto my wallet, and then I heard the exchange went away. I said, what's your wallet? He says, he had a Nano. And I'm like, dude, hook it up to your computer. He didn't understand. I said, you did it exactly right. You did exactly what you're supposed to do. You moved, and he's like, oh my God, I've got like X thousand dollars in Bitcoin sitting here. And I'm like, there you go. So,
more money, more problems.
Yeah, all right, thanks everyone. Leave us a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube. Tell all your friends, and we will see you all next week.